Okay, my job in a somewhat truncated amount of time is to tell you a little bit about the library and its role as a starting point for researchers. I think it's fair to say that the library's role in some respects has been diminished in collection development, partly due to the rise of the big deals. But I think we have to still focus on the very important point that libraries are still very relevant in information discovery. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with a reminder about all the different paths that readers typically take to content, and then look specifically at the library's role in that area. First of all, I want to thank you that my outlook does not look like that this morning. I was worried, being in the last group, that that may be my view of it. But, so thanks for so many people still being here. I'm very happy about that. Anyway, back to the main bit. Just as a reminder, and it's useful to remember that readers of scholarly content have an awful lot of different starting points where they may do when they start their research. Subject, abstracting and indexing, databases, PubMed, Web of Science, Scopus. In fact, hundreds of these databases exist. Major search engines like Google. Web gateways, the likes of Ingenta Connect, subscription agent gateways, and other portals that are on the web, as well as the library gateway. I'm going to play around with some data from Alexa, mainly because you can have such a lot of fun misinterpreting deliberately statistics, and I'm just going to do that and show you, as an aside, really, how easily you can misinterpret data. But then take one major take-home from the next few slides. This is from Alexa.com. And it's a plot of the percentage of users arriving on publisher websites and taking a single page view before leaving. As you can see here, the figure for Ingenta Connect was 72%. Is that me booming somehow, or is that something else? Is that because I'm just very loud? Move it down a bit. Is that better?
Yeah.
Less boomy. Okay, good. 72% of the people that come to Ingenta Connect stay there for just one page view. So there's a lot of wow factor here. You can say, wow, that's rubbish. 72% of the people come to Ingenta leave straight away. Or you can say, wow, that's fantastic. 72% of the people come to Ingenta find what they want straight away and don't need to go any further. So you have to be very, very careful how you interpret these data. And you can see these different sites, and they're sort of semi-selected at random, have varying results. But what is common to almost all of them is it's almost every case more than half of the users are making a single page view, and by definition, therefore, they started somewhere else. They come to the site. They didn't start on those sites. This is the same plot turned the other way up, which means look at those sites. Now, which one the users are making multiple page views? And there's a lot of wow in this, again. You can say, wow, look at Science Direct. How sticky is that site? They make 5.9 page views if they stay longer than that first page view. And so they must be looking at other good stuff. Or you could say, wow, how treacly is that site? It takes them 5.9 page views to find what they wanted. So again, be very, very careful how you interpret these data. But if you just look at those figures, the figures at the bottom there, sorry, tiny brackets, you'll see at the bottom, actually tells you for those people that make multiple page views, how many page views they make on average in each of those sites. And although it's tiny, you can't see, it's 5.9 for Science Direct, 5.2 on ProQuest. 3.9 on IOP and AIP, which I thought was quite interesting in itself. Maybe it's less about site design, and it made me think, is it more about the subject area? That's as a physicist seem to have the same behavior on two different sites. Maybe complete coincidence, I'll have to look at that another day. Moving on. What about the amount of traffic originating in the search engine? Again, according to Alexa, well, 40% of Ingenta's traffic, 30-something percent of Science Direct, 20-something percent of ProQuest. They're high percentages. None of this is surprising, of course. What is perhaps interesting is how low that ProQuest peak is. And if you're a librarian, it won't be surprising, because you will have recommended it to a very large caucus of undergraduates as being their starting point, rather than a place they will leap to from within another search point. Science Direct often shows results like this, where, because again, it's kind of a big enough collection in its own right for people to start their work there rather than needing to leap to it so much, which is quite interesting. So what about the rest? Well, this is just a chart of typical referrers. You wouldn't be able to apply this to any one publisher, but I've just looked across. This is from experience. I suppose it's semi-anecdotal, really, of how it might look. 40% of referrers from other sites is Google. And then quite often 3 or 4% in the life sciences, NIH, PubMed, and the likes. 3% or so from Yahoo. Another 3% from Facebook, which I think is quite interesting at the moment, you're starting to see. So maybe those scientists have found their social network, and they are sharing billions of article links inside Facebook with each other. If we're starting to see 3% of referrers to scientific literature coming from Facebook, that's quite a lot. And the DOI there is about 2% in this chart, and that's been, I think, fairly typical for a long time. But that's only the start of it, and that's the problem, really, because if you start carrying on down the chain looking at more and more referrers, you'll end up, there's lots of other, other sites, others I've put down there, and then you get into the libraries. Library. Hundreds and hundreds or thousands of libraries referring traffic to you at probably about 0.1% each or less. When you take them in aggregate, however, it becomes interesting again. So you don't see that, and a lot of publishers I know, when they're studying their weblogs, just see, and they might just about get to see Stanford as a referrer in their weblogs, it's significant enough, but of course there's this enormously long tail of 10,000 libraries with library web pages linking to your sites, each sending some tiny amount of traffic. But of course they have one thing in common, they're using probably only one of about 10 brands of library technology underneath. So they're really, effectively, 10 pieces of technology referring an awful lot of the traffic. So it's important to remember that most users still arrive at a publisher's website from another site or a link in an email or RSS, and not from navigating their way around the publisher's site. There are lots of places to start navigation as well, but in aggregate, the library website seems to account for an awful lot of the traffic. It's complicated. Different kinds of users have different modes of use. They may navigate via the library website and then on to e-resources. They may well go via a library website onto a professional A&I, a Scopus, a web of science and so on, and then come to your content. They may go via a library website via another kind of gateway to your content. They may obviously go directly to gateways and A&Is, or indeed directly to the content. So there's all these different paths that users are taking through to your material. But the library is involved quite considerably. But there's a fight out there, because who owns that starting point is rather powerful. And starting, obviously, Google being one of those very big, powerful places. But starting points, these starting points succeed by attracting market share of users to the starting point, and then are funded either by advertising, the likes of Google, by a subscription if you've got a paid-for abstracting indexing service, maybe by charging people for inclusion in the index, or for the sale of additional services like subscriptions from the subscription agents or document delivery. As options. So these they try and gain popularity and then sell on the back of that popularity or sell access through that route itself. Interestingly, libraries have to compete with all those other starting points to maintain their brand in that whole transaction, and actually, consequently, maybe their relevance. If libraries are being increasingly relegated to being the purchasers of content less than they are the selectors of content, especially with the advent of the big deal, then intermediating the navigation becomes very, very important. And being visible in that intermediation becomes very, very important for the library. So they have to compete. And libraries compete with Google. They compete with other... They actually end up competing effectively for other with other resources that they purchase for their clients. The library web pages, however, do have a unique benefit because they are the only starting point that a user can take on the web, which has knowledge across multiple publisher sites of what the user is licensed to read. They have knowledge of the subscriptions. The library generally doesn't bother indexing stuff it hasn't bought because it's somewhat futile. Also, the library technologies that they've deployed are heavily integrated with other starting points as well, so the libraries do get involved that way. And as said earlier, although libraries may make up a tiny proportion individually, in aggregate they are quite significant. This is the output of a survey that was undertaken now 3 years ago, and actually you're going to try and repeat it in 2011. And this is a question to predominantly life scientists, as it turned out, and predominantly North America and Western Europe. We asked the question, how often do you think that technology deployed by your institution's library affects how you navigate to e-journals? And that big peak on the right there, at the bottom, it says effectively that 60% of the people felt that library technology affected their navigation more than 95% of the time. So that's a very, very significant effect. That doesn't mean to say they started necessarily at the library web pages, because there are actually whole arrays of library technology which aid, some say, may hinder user navigation, but they are there and are part of that navigation. I'm just going to show you just a few screenshots of some of these more advanced library web pages. This is a screenshot from a few years ago at Open Bar Amsterdam. And it's you've got a simple search box up at the top, so it's a bit more Google-like and a bit more user-friendly. You've got a faceted search mechanism. You've got effectively tag-based searching at the side. And what's interesting is it's searching locally held resources, but just in that bottom right-hand corner as well, it's integrating search results from external sites at the same time as you go. So it's not just indexing what is actually held local to the library, but it's indexing, it's searching remotely and then incorporating the results back. Now we're going to move on to the very latest initiatives in library technology, which is referred to as web-scale discovery. This is a leap to very much current day. It's a technology layer which is taking off very, very quickly in libraries. There's a lot of libraries have bought into this. And the concept is very simple. It's actually quite Google-like. The idea is that the library technology companies come and talk to large numbers of publishers and database owners and say, give us the metadata from your the databases for us to hold centrally in an optimized and, in fact, normalized database, so that users within the library can make a quick search. Now, the advantage to the library of that, and obviously the advantage to the user of that, in theory, is they get a simple Google-like experience, but searching only the information that the librarian has done the collection development on, that has decided that it is useful to have. So again, it's the latest thing in the libraries effectively trying to compete with Google as that starting point for their users. They're very quite fascinating, really, what's available when you start looking at these things. This is a screenshot provided to me by the people at Ex Libris with their Primo product. You see at the top, they've got a search going on up there, ancient DNA repair, and it's searching across multiple databases as normalized into a single Primo-hosted database. And it's coming up with results, which you then link out to the publisher's content, wherever it is. So it's obviously just another great starting point. What I quite like about this particular one is it has this recommendation section here. Because although it's looking at indexing everything of interest to you in your library, it's actually also telling you recommended other articles based on the usage of other users across the world. People that typically clicked on this article have also read those. It's taking that information in aggregate across a large body of libraries into this database. So it's very powerful stuff. I'm nearly there, don't worry. So from the primary publisher's point of view, you're looking at what web-scale discovery does for you. It very much enhances the discoverability of publisher content. I mean, why wouldn't you? It's simple. It's not as if anybody gains access to anything they haven't paid for. They merely get to search it better. Users are linked out to the full text on the publisher website. It's effectively the same arrangement as you'd have with a Google on e-journals. If you happen to be an extremely large publisher where users might conceivably come to your site and do a search there, then it slightly diminishes the case for that publisher website as a starting point. So it's a bit of a balance. The trick is it's much tougher if you happen to be a secondary publisher, an A&I publisher. Now, the discovery products only index the subscribed content, so by including your A&I database into these discovery platforms, you reinforce the value of the data in the index and maybe help guarantee the viability of the index itself, because the library is going to keep subscribing to the indexes you produce. The trouble is, at the same time, you lose your brand, and your search interface, which is the big thing you're selling, is no longer the starting point itself. And this is a big problem. Users link out from the discovery product to the full text. They never see your indexing product. And the other big downer is that the users only get a subset of the functionality of the specialist search. Each of these A&Is will have very much specialist interfaces that allow you to drill down through the subject thesauri, and all that stuff tends to get dropped away. It's a very, very tough choice for A&I publishers. On the one hand, buying into this kind of cements their relationship with the library, but on the other hand, it definitely takes away a lot of their brand visibility. The library, potentially a very powerful tool that helps cement the library's role in information discovery, but they still have an awful lot of competition to consider. So I think that's about it for me. Thank you very much.